Coming up, our next to last episode of Religion and Ethics News Weekly. We look back at some of the most memorable stories we've covered, people we've met, and changes we've seen. This week, Fred DeSam Lazaro, Tim O'Brien, Judy Valente, and I offer our reflections.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us for this next-to-last program in our series that began nearly 20 years ago. We asked our reporters and producers to recall the stories they liked best over the years and chose several of them for this week's broadcast and next week's, our final show. My own favorite has been conversations with preachers and scholars of many traditions who talked with us about their deepest religious beliefs. One of them was the great South African Nobel Prize winner, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He was spending the year 1998 at Emory University in Atlanta, where I talked with him about many things, including his morning prayer. As he spoke, you could hear a pin drop.
I have come to realize more and more that prayer, it's just being in the presence of one who loves you deeply, who loves you with a love that will not let you go. And so when I get up in the morning, I try to spend as much time as I can in the sense of being quiet in the presence of this love. And it's often like saying, I want to be sitting, it's a cold day, and I'm sitting in front of a warm fire. I don't have to do anything. The fire warms me. All I have to do is to be there in front of the fire. And after a while, I may have the qualities of the fire change me. So I have the warmth of the fire. I may have the glow of the fire. And it is so also with me and God that I just have to be there, quiet.
Hi, how are you?
The late Phyllis Tickle, a writer who died a year and a half ago, practiced what she called fixed-hour prayer. Every 3 hours, her alarm went off, and she would stop whatever she was doing and pray, usually by reading out loud. Before she died, Phyllis had completed a series of books called The Divine Hours, written prayers for every part of every day.
Be thou exalted above the heavens, O God, in thy glory over all the earth.
I do this because we're told in Christianity that there must be constant prayer in our lives, and also that there should be a constant cascade of prayer offered before the throne of God. It's not petitionary. Unlike much prayer, it doesn't ask for anything. It simply glorifies God and acknowledges Him. It's also a way, I think, of remembering who it is I'm not and how very little I matter.
It's been a year, and I must say you don't look a day older.
One of the heroes of the civil rights movement was Reverend Gardner Taylor, who became the senior minister at the Concord Baptist Church in Brooklyn and one of the most admired preachers in the country. Kim Lawton spoke with him.
You do not want to strive to be known as a great preacher. You do want to strive for people to feel when you have tried to preach what a great gospel it is.
Taylor keeps busy, but in recent years, he says he's begun to practice what 19th century British pastor Alexander McLaren called sitting silent before God.
This is not praying. It is not reading. It is just opening oneself. It's a mystic kind of thing. But we do so little of it. And we who preach are likely to engage ourselves in so many things and to neglect that aspect of being open to what God has to say. And I wish to heaven I had practiced this more early on in my ministry.
Eugene Peterson is a retired Presbyterian minister, best known for his translation of the entire Bible into everyday American English. I went to see him and his wife Jan at their home in the spectacular Flathead Valley in Montana, and I asked him about his theology. I was amazed by his reply. He said he had little time for anything abstract. He listens for the holy, he said, in people and in the quiet places he loves.
How do you pay attention to the unheard, the unseen? In a cluttered, noisy, distracted society, it's very hard to do it. A lot of the language in the church, well, not just the church, in religion itself, has to do with trying to figure out the truth of things. What's true? What's true? You know, I'm not really interested in what's true. I want to know if I can live it.
Listening for the holy was also important to the novelist Frederick Buechner. I talked with him at his home in Vermont, where he lives in what he calls fathomless obscurity. He, too, is an ordained Presbyterian minister, but he says he's never had a church and rarely attends one. His writing, he says, is his ministry.
Well, what makes me a believer is that from time to time, going back almost as far as my memory will go back, there have been glimpses I've had, sometimes literally a glimpse, which have made me suspect the presence of something extraordinary and beyond the realm of the immediate. You encounter the holy in various forms, which, unless you have your eyes open, you might not even notice. They're so subtle, they're so elusive. The phrase, listen to your life, observe, that wonderful phrase, religious observances, means, among other things, I think just what it says, observe religiously.
And then we talked about suffering.
You can't pretend it doesn't exist. You can't believe in an all-powerful, all-loving God and look at the horrors. But my answer to myself is don't give up hope. Don't give up hope. God is greater than all of those things. The holy, the more, transcends all of the wretchedness.
God can only forgive us.
Another man who's thought hard about suffering is the former chief rabbi of Britain, Jonathan Sacks. I had a conversation with him in New York.
No Jew, knowing our history, can be an optimist. But no Jew worthy of the name ever gave up hope. The story of the Jewish people is the story of the victory of hope over despair, and of the spirit over every kind of physical power. We are the people who never gave up hope. And I want to say to you, you needn't be an optimist, but you must never give up hope, because together we can make a better world.
One of the most eloquent of those we talked with was the late William Sloan Coffin, Jr. He'd been the chaplain at Yale University, he'd marched with Martin Luther King, Jr., and he'd led movements against the Vietnam War and nuclear weapons. I talked with him at his home in Vermont. Two strokes had slurred his speech, but he managed to express himself with limitless power.
It's clear to me two things, that almost every square inch of the earth's surface is soaked with the tears and blood of the innocent. Two, it's not God's doing, It's our doing. That's human malpractice. Don't chalk it up to God. Every time people say, when they see the innocent suffering, every time they lift their eyes to heaven and say, God, how could you let it happen? It's well to remember that exactly that moment, God is asking exactly that same question of us. How could you let it happen? When you get older, nature gets more interesting the nearer you get to joining it, and also more beautiful. I mean, I can sit on the front porch here and just sit there and watch the sun coming in through the maple leaves. You know, God is good.
One of the many privileges of doing this program has been meeting and talking with men and women such as these. They were all good company. I think often of Bill Coffin quoting the church father Irenaeus, "The glory of God is a human being fully alive." Over the years, Supreme Court decisions have had great impact on American society. Tim O'Brien looks at some of those decisions and how the court has changed.
The Supreme Court has been emphatic about the need for the law to be clear and consistent. But given the complexity of the issues it is called on to decide and changing personnel on the court,
congratulations and welcome to the court.
It frequently is neither. For example, in 1985, the court prohibited tax dollars going to parochial schools. Excessive government entanglement with religion, the court said. 12 years later, following the appointment of more conservative justices, the court flipped on that, even allowing public school teachers to teach in Catholic schools. The appointment of Justice Anthony Kennedy, after the bruising confirmation fight over Robert Bork in 1987, shows how a single appointment can change our world. Kennedy wrote the 5-4 decision against benedictions at high school commencement ceremonies. Bork has written critically of that decision, which presumably would have gone the other way had he been confirmed. And others, like abortion. In 1992, Kennedy provided the 5th vote to reaffirm Roe v. Wade, the landmark abortion decision, instead of overruling it, as the president who appointed him had hoped.
Thank you, Mr. President.
It is unusual for the court to flatly overrule itself, but it has happened in several hot-button cases, and again, one justice, often Anthony Kennedy, has played a pivotal role.
Kennedy has become a champion for gay rights. In 2003, he wrote the landmark decision throwing out Texas's sodomy law, overruling a 1986 decision allowing states to criminalize homosexual behavior. And 2 years ago, he wrote another groundbreaking decision, effectively legalizing same-sex marriage nationwide. And the death penalty. In 1989, the court had upheld the death penalty for offenders under the age of 18 and for those found to be mildly retarded. Both decisions subsequently overruled on 5-4 votes, with Kennedy again figuring prominently in the outcome. Another potentially seismic change occurred when Justice Sandra O'Connor, a moderate, retired in 2006, to be replaced by the more conservative Samuel Alito. That swap has left the court less receptive to affirmative action, but more amenable to government accommodation of religion.
Let us pray.
For example, it is well established that government bodies may begin their sessions with a short prayer. But 3 years ago, the court allowed Greece, New York to begin its town council meetings with a ceremony that resembled a Catholic mass.
Jesus Christ, who took away the sins of the world.
Justice Alito provided the needed 5th vote. Justice O'Connor would likely have steered the court in a different direction. The court has had a delicate ideological balance over the last 30 years, with Justice Kennedy often finding himself in the middle, the so-called swing justice. The impact of President Trump's choice of Neil Gorsuch to replace Antonin Scalia, if confirmed, is not expected to affect that balance, as Gorsuch is believed to share Scalia's conservative views. Gorsuch is all but certain to be asked at his confirmation hearings about his view, like Scalia's, that the Constitution must be interpreted as it was written when adopted in 1789. History teaches otherwise.
In the past 20 years, we've seen 5 vacancies on the court and changing attitudes on a wide range of social issues, like gay rights and same-sex marriage. Times do change, and so do the justices. For better or for worse, what the Constitution really means would seem to have changed over the years, right along with them. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien in Washington.
Some of the most powerful stories we've run on this program were discovered and told by Fred DeSam Lazaro. He traveled to many parts of the world to bring back the wrenching accounts of the very poor and those trying to help them.
It somehow feels appropriate that the very last story I filed for this program was from Calcutta last week about the legacy of Mother Teresa. It was from this city and on the very same subject that I did my very first story for Religion and Ethics News Weekly. In nearly 2 decades, in hundreds of reports, gray, like my own scalp, became a dominant color. Few issues can be seen in absolutely black and white terms. They are fraught with complexity and often unforeseen consequences. Take surrogate motherhood. It was a billion-dollar industry in India in which poor women were hired to carry the fetuses of foreign biological parents.
These women, they don't want my child. It's very cut and dry. They do not want my child. They want my money. And that is just fine with me.
It's not fine with everyone.
And the contracts usually are written, to be blunt, to protect the wealthy people who are commissioning the baby.
In 2016, India banned transnational surrogacy. Then there's the wrenching issue of abortion, which is now banned in the predominantly Catholic nation of El Salvador.
Since 1997, abortion has been illegal in El Salvador with no exceptions, which had once existed for cases such as rape, incest, or a threat to the mother's life. Dozens of women have been prosecuted for illegal abortion, in some cases for aggravated homicide.
In India, on the other hand, abortion on demand is legal, but it is used widely to terminate female pregnancies in a land where boys are preferred. Sex selection is illegal, but the law is hard to enforce, as we found in this candid exchange with a Mumbai obstetrician.
I'm not in favor of it.
Okay, but do you do it occasionally when requested to?
Yeah, I do. I often deny that.
And terminations are the chief source of your income?
Very much, very much.
Much more than delivering babies?
Very much, very much.
The sobering content notwithstanding, candid interviews are a kind of journalistic holy grail, since they help powerfully deliver a story. Many of my stories have concerned human suffering, and one of the most effective ways to tell these is through the work of social innovators and entrepreneurs, many driven by deep faith. Like Sister Cyril Mooney, that other nun from Calcutta, whose pioneering work in educating poor children has won worldwide acclaim.
Our approach is to educate the child, put the child standing on their feet, give them a good job, and then they're settled for life.
We profiled Dr. Catherine Hamlin treating women with fistulas in Ethiopia. And Sunita Krishnan providing refuge and training for trafficked young women in India. Entrepreneur Chid Liberty started a garment industry in his native Liberia despite Ebola. Like this one, most poverty alleviation ideas place an emphasis on improving the lives of women. The payoff is higher, experts say, because women focus their energy on their families and communities. Men focus on themselves. At the Barefoot College, which trains rural women to become solar technicians, founder Bunker Roy put it this way.
We've come to the sad conclusion men are untrainable. They're restless.
Humor is always a powerful storytelling tool. And finally, thanks to Bob Abernethy and the team at Religion and Ethics News Weekly. It's been a million-mile journey, literally, to dozens of countries, making the foreign just a little less foreign. I could not have dreamed that it would take me to Kalamazoo and indeed to Timbuktu. You saw it all here. This is Fred DeSam Lazaro.
Our correspondent Judy Valente has reported stories over the years about individuals committed to improving the world and the many ways people seek the transcendent. She herself is an accomplished poet.
In my years reporting for Religion and Ethics, I interviewed many people who not only had compelling stories to tell, but ended up deeply touching my own life. One of those unforgettable people lived in tiny Pineapple, Alabama, a place so poor many residents still get their water from outdoor spigots. Dr. Roseanne Cook cared for the poorest of Pineapple's poor. Not known to most of her patients, she also happens to be a sister of St. Joseph, a Catholic nun. She told one story I will never forget about being robbed on a secluded road.
Threw me in the trunk here, said, "You're dead," and started shooting.
And amazingly, they all missed you.
I take that as an act of God that, I'm here to talk about it. Women between the age of
25 and 44. A story about the efforts by churches to address the spread of AIDS among young African Americans brought me to the Mississippi Delta, where I met another courageous doctor from Africa who was trying to make a difference in this country.
The exchange of sex is often the only essential that, unfortunately, some younger women are left with in order to be able to obtain some money for, you know, the daily essentials of living.
Several months after our broadcast, I learned that Dr. Brima committed suicide, the result, his friends said, of the emotional toll he faced confronting daily devastating poverty, suffering, and death in the Delta.
Milk and honey.
There were many uplifting stories, too. In 2003, I got to sit next to the piano at the home of one of my favorite composers, Jerry Herman.
You give my old julep a kick.
The characters that I choose to write about are all optimistic, life-affirming people.
A few years later, I profiled another extraordinary musician, singer-songwriter Carrie Newcomer, whose Quaker beliefs infuse her humanitarian work around the world, as well as the often spiritual lyrics of her folk songs.
I do use spiritual language sometimes in my work, but I do it very carefully. In a lot of contemporary Christian music, you get 8 crayons to paint with. That's all you get. But I'm kind of a 48 crayon kind of gal theologically.
Perhaps the most memorable person I interviewed was the insouciant Trappist monk, Brother Paul Quinin, from the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky.
I think the purpose of the monastic life in the modern world is to show that we don't need a purpose. The purpose of life is life, and you are to be just to be. Everybody measures their importance by how useful they are. That's not it. That's not what life is.
The famous monk and writer Thomas Merton encouraged Brother Paul to write poetry. Brother Paul was at work on his 4th poetry collection when we met. He told us he writes a 3-line poem, a Japanese haiku, every day as part of his meditation practice. After that interview, Brother Paul and I began exchanging a haiku a day. We did this for 2 years.
Above dim snowfields, lone light of Venus, lone wail of goose pleading for spring.
He and I eventually collected our haiku and several short reflections we wrote to go with them into a book called The Art of Pausing, Meditations for the Overworked and Overwhelmed. I remember him and so many of the others I've interviewed with great fondness. I'm Judy Valente.
That's our program for now. Please join us again next week as we continue to look back in our final program. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, more behind-the-scenes pictures of our Religion and Ethics team over the years.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.